I think we'll get started because we've got so much to cover today. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Yeah, I got your emails.
Unfortunately, our Badgers were not playing in the game last night, but wasn't it a fabulous run? Such a great, great season for them. And for our Marquette Warriors / Eagles, we've got a new coach, so that'll be exciting for next year. There's always next year. We today are having a fabulous program on mediation, specific tips for effective mediation. And I'm really excited, and Ryan Blay is going to be our moderator, and he's going to introduce our panel. So I won't go into that, although I normally do. Next month in May, and please note it's a day change. We're usually on the second Tuesday. We're going to be here on the first Tuesday because the second Tuesday is the Seventh Circuit Conference in Chicago. But on the first Tuesday, we're going to have Judge Pepper and a panel discussing how to use deposition transcripts, Rule 2004 exam transcripts, 341 transcripts in evidence in trials and hearings. So I know that comes up, it causes confusion, so please come on back the first Tuesday in May for Judge Pepper and a panel on using depositions and 341 transcripts, etc. In June, very excited about this. It's back to the second Tuesday. Mont Martin is putting together a program based off of the public radio program MOTH. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it involves telling kind of 5-minute improv stories, and there's got to be a moral. So we're going to have a whole host of people, and we're looking for people to participate, so please don't be shy. Talk to Mont or Ryan. If you want to get up and tell a 5-minute story about a bankruptcy case or a litigation or something in law school, whatever you want to do, that would have a moral. We think it's going to be a lot of fun, and we're very excited about it. That'll be for June, sort of a summer vacation kind of fun program. So we hope you'll get excited about that and come back and indeed even participate. Without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Ryan Blake.
Thank you, Judge, and good morning, and please welcome a great panel today. On my far left, we have Bill Gennaro. Bill is a former circuit court judge from Milwaukee County. He's currently the principal at W.A. Gennaro Law and also a counsel to Gimbel, Riley, Guerin, and Brown. He's mediated over 1,000 matters and is consistently named one of the best mediators in Wisconsin. So if you're looking for someone who's an expert on mediation in the state court setting, we'll always turn to Bill. And Bill is a Marquette graduate, as is Deb Tuttle, who's on my near left. If you've done anything with state court mediation and foreclosures or tried to work with the Triple M program in the bankruptcy court, you can probably thank Deb for that. Deb's the executive director and chief mediator for the Wisconsin Foreclosure Mediation Network and the Metro Milwaukee Foreclosure Mediation Program. She also received last year's Dale Eilenfeld Award, along with Nathan DeLaterante and Jay Pittner, for her work in setting up the Triple M program, and has been instrumental in getting that set up in the Western District as well. Deb was formerly in private practice as well, also has her JD from Marquette, and is president of the State Bar Section on Dispute Resolution. We also have, you can't see him because he's on the phone with us today, from Seattle, attorney Jeffrey Groshong, who is a partner at Miller Nash in their Seattle office. Jeff is ABC certified in business bankruptcy, got his JD from Northwestern, and in addition to his 30 plus years representing debtors, creditors, trustees, and so forth, he's also on the U.S. Bankruptcy Court mediation panel in the Western District of Washington. So I think we're going to start this program first by turning to Bill and discussing what exactly ADR is. And we'll go from there.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a great introduction, by the way.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Great advertising. All right. Well, where to start on something like alternative dispute resolution, which has grown from a tiny kernel back in the 80s and early 90s into a full bloom of practice and participation by lawyers and parties. And my own personal involvement in the ADR process actually began with a referral. Well, actually, it was a second one. I had heard about ADR because it was kicking around in the early, late 80s, early 90s. And when I was on the bench in the Circuit Court of Milwaukee County, lawyers would come in with the jury in the box ready to go, and we would start talking about how to settle this case. And they'd tell me the story, and I'd say, okay, I'd tell the plaintiff, you're not going to get all that much money, you're going to have to pay, or tell the defense they're going to have to pay more. And it got pushed and shoved, and get the adjuster on the phone, and that's how you settle the case back in those days. The judge pushed it, and so now I'm off the bench, and I get a call from a couple lawyers saying they want me to do a mediation, and I said, okay, I figure that's just like what I did when I was a judge. So the people came in, and I told them what I thought and who should win, and they left. I said, I think I did something wrong here. It's not working the way it's supposed to. So I called Dan Noonan, who was over at Marquette Law as an associate professor, and I heard him say, I saw him for coffee one day, and he had told me about the stuff he's doing with the mediation. I said, what did I do wrong? And he said, everything. Everything. It's just the worst way to handle a mediation. You don't mediate. You were, just telling him like you were still the judge. And I said, okay. Well, he referred me to a book called Getting the Yes. And I'm sure anybody who's thought about mediation and like knows about that book. So I looked at it, took a look at it, and I saw all the things they'd done wrong. And maybe a week later, I got a call from Dale Eilenfeld. And that's the reason I bring this up, is that he said, I want to know if you'd like to or will mediate a case for me. And I said, sure, of course, I can do anything, whatever. Well, it turns out it was a 26-party case in the bankruptcy court, and it involved price fixing and theft of steel all over the United States, and it ended up in the bankruptcy court here. So this was quite different than the personal injury thing that I bombed on the month before. And we had, like I said, 26 parties. Each one had at least one lawyer. We did it in a conference room at Foley and Lardner up on the 97th floor, wherever that is, way up there. You can see the world. And it was, we lasted 5 full days, and on Saturday morning it settled. 25 of 26 parties settled. The one that didn't settle went to prison. He was the price fixer, thief guy who was doing all that stuff. But that was my introduction to mediation, and I was learning as I was moving along the process. And the federal system was a touch ahead of Wisconsin in that I think in 1990 the Administrative Dispute Resolution Act was passed, and that required the different sections of the federal government to adopt a policy on ADR. Wisconsin caught up with that a touch later out of the Supreme Court, and that was interesting because the section that it's in the state code is in the litigation procedure section, and the last one, sub 12 of 802, deals with alternative dispute resolution. So it's kind of like it just sort of jarring to get to that part, because everything is on litigation, and then settlement issues. So the corollary to 802.12 in the federal system is 28 U.S.C. 651, I think it's still the code that covers. There's all kinds of ADR systems in the state statute. Only one of them is mediation, and it's not even listed until the fifth alternative in the process. It has become the single most used alternative dispute resolution procedure amongst all of the other nine, there are 10 altogether, 10, that one is the most used. And it's used because it has a, I think, a basic concept, which is sitting people down, and we, Deb and I talked about this yesterday, preferably a round table.
So they can't reach each other.
So they can't reach over the table, because sometimes that has happened, actually. And it happened, it really did. I mean, I had mediation where a lawyer went after another party across the table. But that was early on, and things have changed so much in the process. Lawyers today, I hate to sound like a fossil, but the lawyers today are much more tuned into the idea of settlement than they were 15 years ago, 20 years ago, because lawyers coming out of law schools now are tuned into the process, and litigation is becoming less likely to occur, actual jury trial or court trial, than mediation. Mediation is now standard. When I was still on the bench, we were working on a scheduling order to standardize it, because every judge has his or her own scheduling order. So you'd have a different order from coming out of 15 different circuit courts. Well, now we worked on putting together a standard, and what ultimately ended up in there, it was after I had left, but what ended up in there is a standard order for alternative dispute resolution to be conducted by a certain date and the like. And so anyway, the idea is to encourage cooperation versus litigation. That's the, I mean, the differences are so dramatic, and our, you know, our culture has a lot of conflict-based resolutions. You know, conflict, whether it's a basketball game like last night, that was, you know, those guys were on the court battling each other, or football, or baseball. Whatever, all the sports things are all based on the idea of defeating, one side winning, one side losing. And our culture has adopted a lot of that. And so people, when they go to court, you know, they see hiring the lawyer as the modern-day equivalent of the medieval lords hiring a knight to do a battle on the fields of Runnymede. And what do you think what do you think those people were called, the knights? Retainers. That was their concept. The retainer is still here with us, isn't it? You have to pay the lawyer a retainer. Well, the idea is that you're going to war, and you are going to prepare for war, and you have to get everything lined up to do that. And now the judge is saying, and it's very difficult for parties, maybe less so for business parties than it is for individual parties in litigation. But the idea is that you have hired a lawyer, you're going into court, you're going to have a trial, and now you've been told you have to visit with a mediator, meet somebody who's a mediator. What the hell's a mediator? I mean, people, a lot don't even know what that is. But the idea is that that changes the perception and the approach from conflict, defeating, winning, defeating, to finding an agreed-upon resolution that people aren't oftentimes not prepared to make that transfer mentally, unless the lawyers have done what they do now so much better than they used to do. I'm serious when I say that. You know, I had lawyers say, and this years ago, I'm only here because the judge ordered it. We're not going to settle this case. You know, okay, well, why don't you sit down and have a cookie? I mean, well, that's what we've done. So the idea is that the conflict has, as the pattern and the method, is really, I think, kind of being succeeded by the idea of resolving, resolution, and you know, if there's some of this, you know, in my little outline thing, I mentioned the four C's of mediation, which, you know, what a mediation gives to the client, it gives certainty, as to the outcome, because the most uncertain aspect of litigation is the uncertainty of it. That's, I mean, nobody knows what's going to happen when you go, when you swing through the gate, and what the judge is going to rule on any given motion, any bit of evidence, any objection one way or another. So that's what you replace or with, you replace the uncertainty with certainty, number one. Containment, you're containing the cost, and not only dollar costs for the parties, the legal fees, expert witnesses, expenses, depositions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but it's also the containment of the involvement of the parties to the litigation. And in business, that can be, in business litigation, that can be, can have widespread impact on a business parties to who's going to be involved in it, what, you know, so that's, and control. The control is in the hands of the parties. It's hard oftentimes for people to really understand that they are in control, not their lawyers, not the judge, not the jury, but they. They're the decision makers. And ultimately, it comes down to what can I live with, basically. And that's, and you can apply that not only on a personal level, but on a business level. Where do, you know, where do I go from here? How do I continue on moving forward from where we've been? And gosh, you know, I've met people a number of years after the mediation has concluded and it had settled, and had them say, you know, Judge, I didn't think we could ever settle that case. I mean, I thought it was never going to ever settle, but it did. And I can tell you that every night before I fell asleep, I thought about that case. I thought about it. It just was in my back of my brain. And since the mediation, I haven't thought about it at all until I saw you today. So I mean, that's a real good feeling or interaction from a party, you know, 2-3 years after the event is over. And closure. And closure is the connected up to that point is the it ends the process for people. And oh, I've been talking way too long. I'm sorry.
Well, you mentioned the sea change about the from the mindset of we're definitely going to take this to trial to okay, let's see if we can work this out. Do you still notice a difference between a court-ordered or a mandatory ADR versus ADR that comes from the wishes of the parties themselves?
Yes. I've had a number of mediations where it wasn't yet in court, where they asked to do a mediation in advance of the suit being filed. And those have been almost uniformly successful. I mean, every one of those settled, almost settled, like a couple that didn't. But that's different than the court order. The court order, a lot, oftentimes I get feedback from people when you do individual sessions. Well, I didn't know I was going to have to pay you, too. Well, I'm sorry. But you do. It's kind of like part of the program. Well, I didn't, you know, I hired a lawyer. I didn't know a law firm or whatever. And now I'm going to, now we have to pay a mediator. And I said, well, yeah, sorry. But that's the way it goes. I mean, how do you deal with that kind of attitude? I give them a cookie for sure. That's when they get a cookie. Please have a cookie, you know. Please. So.
Now, Jeff, how does the bankruptcy court in the Western District of Wisconsin, Washington, handle mediation?
It's non-mandatory, but the parties can request to be assigned to the mediation program, and they can ask for a mediator and a backup mediator. Is that the response to your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And what sort of cases are being referred to mediation?
A wide variety, and including almost any fact pattern really you could imagine, any cause of action. But the the usual suspects are seem amenable to mediation, successful mediation. Exception to discharge under 523 of the bankruptcy code. Those are obviously are not usually brought by creditors of individual debtors, but sometimes there are piercing the veil and going after the owners of the debtor, discharge exception actions. 542 of the code, turnover action, usually brought by the benefit brought by the trustee on behalf of the estate, sometimes against, very often, you know, there's pre-petition timing where new corporations are set up or companies file Chapter 7 and keep on doing business. 547 references, reference claims are good for mediation. 548 fraudulent conveyances. And then within those, and I think those are the sort of the basic starting points, a number of state fraud claim causes could be mediated at one where a creditor brought a claim against for unlawful distributions to shareholders, where the creditor claimed a commission from the earned pre-petition from the company that filed bankruptcy, and under our corporate uniform law, but if you're going to dissolve, you have to pay your debts before you make distributions to equity. Not the shorthand list of what I'm speaking.
Wonderful. And to what extent are the bankruptcy court judges involved in the mediation program?
They're enthusiastic supporters of it. We have one judge in particular, Karen Overstreet, who has been on the steering committee for this program since it came out of the box about 2.5 years ago. They like it. They have I don't know if it's like Wisconsin or not, they have high caseloads, and they're support staff, it's hard to get them replaced due to budgetary constraints, and they're very happy to have matters resolved. And for some of them, and they're also aware of the, they're very happy to have complex, and particularly emotional, cases resolved where the parties resolve them themselves. Those can be very hard for the judges too, and if the parties can work out themselves, we're very happy with that.
The judges are all nodding at that last point, definitely.
Yes. So
we do have the Triple M program here, and also in some maybe cases ADR of other issues, even if the program's not fully developed. We'd like to hear about how the parties can best use ADR, and we can turn to Deb for some tips on mediation. And Jeff, please jump in as well from your experience on how the parties can best use the programs that are available.
So last night I was working on this PowerPoint, and it's, you know, the countdown, like Dave Letterman, top 10 tips for mediation. We're going to start at 10 and move our way to 1. And guess what came on the TV? Letterman doing his top 10 count. I thought, this is perfect. I mean, this is inspiring. This is.
Did he also have top 10 tips for mediation, Deb?
Not mediation. No, it was. Well, I don't want to get into it. It's probably not appropriate for this group. But if you promise not to look ahead, I'll pass these out. Matt, maybe you can help me out. But do not go ahead, okay? And I'm not sure I have enough, so if you can share with your neighbor, there's big print. I came into mediation a different way. I worked in litigation in a law firm in Wausau, Mallory and Zimmerman, and I was a competitive litigator, win at all costs, you know, always more prepared than I needed to be, always anticipating arguments that never happened, very intense You know, I had a little competition with another lawyer in Wausau to see who turned off the light last. My office was on the street, and he'd drive by and honk, like, you know, you beat me this time. But it was exhausting, and I hated billing, because it seemed to me that when you got to the end of a litigated case and you presented that bill, even when there was a win, there was this edge. I was involved in a successful mediation. The mediator was brilliant, and I wanted to find out why. Why did that work? What just happened? And so I went back to school. So instead of learning by doing, I learned by books. I went to Marquette. They had a certificate program in dispute resolution and then a master's program. So I started with the concepts and the theories, and then as I mediated, I'd be like, oh, that's what they're talking about with all these fancy behavioral terms. But it really works. You know, when you're aware of those dynamics and behaviors, you can pinpoint when and how to use them and how to respond strategically as a mediator. And when you know them as an advocate in a mediation, you can take advantage of those as well. So that's the backdrop for these top 10 tips. I'm going to take the evens and you take the odds, Bill. And jump in, Ryan.
Sure.
So top number 10, get all the players to the table. That seems self-explanatory, right? How can you resolve a case if there is someone out there who can cause it to crumble? But we don't always think about that. For example, in insurance cases, subrogated claims. I mean, just be sure, maybe a trustee. I'm not as familiar. Obviously, you guys are all way more familiar with bankruptcy than I am. But at some point, I believe the trustee has some involvement in approving or whatever. Jeff, do you get trustees involved in the cases, or what types of cases do you get trustees involved in coming to the table?
The first answer is yes, and fraudulent conveyance cases and turnover cases and preference cases are where I, and also in the turnover cases I've had a couple where this is America, and some people, some businesses file and keep on doing business, and those turnover cases can, plus other cases can result. So again, primarily 542, 547, and 548. If you're not a banker, sorry. 542, turnover actions, preference actions, and fraudulent conveyance actions. Trustees, because they have, under the economic model they work under, are very pragmatic, and they tend to be very ready to participate in issues.
Excellent. Thank you very much. In terms of when you're thinking about who those people are, all you have to think about is ask yourself the question, who could thwart a settlement? Who could cause it to fall apart?
Well, one of the problems is that sometimes you don't know who could thwart it or make it fall apart. And it's relative, somewhat, not I shouldn't say relatively easy, but easier in a case where there's traditional litigation positions, insurance company or this or that, one business or another. But oftentimes I had one, there was a probate court dispute that had been going on and ended up in litigation, and we spent several days doing this thing and working it through with, you know, number with 1, 2, 3, 4 lawyers on the matter, and thought we had it settled, and then one of the parties called a relative, like a sister or brother or something, and that's the person who pulled the pin on it, and they weren't even involved in the in the mediation. They weren't there. Their name never came up, and I said, "Where did this come from?" Well, I just talked to so and so, my brother, and he said, "Don't do that because, you know, mom's or whatever."
I've had that situation too, where individuals are involved, and you've got a significant other.
Yes.
And significant others with, when you've got a mediation between former spouses, is pretty ticklish. But that sometimes that's the mouthpiece, or it may be mom or dad who's funding the whole thing. And if it's going to be dad's money who's going to pay off the creditor or whatever, better have dad around.
Right. So oftentimes you don't know until you're well into the process, and sometimes even then you don't know. Mm-hmm. Then a phone call gets made and the thing can come apart.
And this kind of ties into to the second one, which is, you know, we're talking about horizontally getting the right parties there, but then think vertically, having the right decision maker there with the right level of authority. And Jeff, you were going to say something. I interrupted you. Sorry about that.
Well, I was going to say about that phone call. I had one. I spent a day on it, and the parties were just about there. Then the defendant made a phone call to her sister, and we were done. Apparently the sister had having all the people in the room with enough knowledge to make the deal is, I'm going to second you on that.
Yep. So, Bill, why don't you speak to number 9? No pawns, only kings. I wanted to stick with your picture of the jousting knights.
Oh, well, thank you.
That's very good. I read your mind.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Actually, I want to say that I want to give all the credit in the world to Deb for putting this together. This was her idea, the idea of the Letterman list and the top 10 and the like. And we did talk about this a bit yesterday, and she had lots of these great ideas, and I just once in a while put in a thought or something. And she put it together last night, and I'm reading it pretty much as you are this morning, except that I had the advantage of talking through a lot of these things with Deb yesterday. The idea of the decision makers being directly involved, what I do when we set up a mediation is I'll send a scheduling letter. Maybe it's from the old days of being a judge, but to let the parties know, the lawyers know, what I'm looking for in the process. And part of it is, of course, the date, the time, where, when I need the materials to be submitted to me, so I can review them for preparation purposes. But also there's a sentence in there which is highlighted. I wish I brought it with me. I'm trying to think of exactly what it says, but the idea is that persons with ultimate authority, something of that nature, must be present unless excused by me. And you know, I don't know if all mediators would feel comfortable using that, but I do, because I've been in this situation before, and I've gotten calls. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that I can come there with authority. Well, no, authority is just something they gave you, and you got a cap, and someone told you what you can do. Well, I want to talk to the person who set the authority, if we can make that, or a panel. I've had a number of people from companies on the phone right from the beginning of the mediation, when we begin the intro of what's going to happen and how it's going to work, because every mediator is different. Not everybody does the joint meeting together. Some people start. In fact, the lawyers will say, well, we don't think we need to start together. We'd like to just go right into the caucus. I say, okay, well, I think that's kind of an awkward way to do it if we're going to try to. The congeniality part. Remember the part about getting together and sitting around a round table, getting to yes. You don't do that when you start off linear in a linear fashion like that. So,
well, you also don't want like the position of saying of having everybody in agreement and then somebody saying, "Okay, I'll take it back to my board."
Exactly. Yeah. Now that, and what happens with governmental authorities, like when there's a suit against the city or county. That has to be approved ultimately by, the Common Council, for example, and so it's set up with the idea of involving the city attorney, who's going to be making the recommendation, and there's at least a comfort level that even though it's got to go back, it's going to go back with the full recommendation of that entity. So,
good, perfect. Next one, number 8. know thy vatna and wetna. How many of you are familiar with those terms? Oh, quite a few. So, best alternative to a mediated or negotiated agreement. Your clients will be thinking that that means what they hope for, what they think they should get. They've been injured, they've been wronged, the contract broken, customers lost, whatever. That's what they're going to think. What can I get at trial? But that's not what it is. It's what can be proven under the appropriate measure of damages based on the evidence that's available, discounted for risk. That's a BATNA. And take the time with your client to figure that out well in advance and alert your client that it moves. Because as you learn more about the evidence, you never know everything up front or there wouldn't be a lawsuit, right? As you learn more, it's going to change. It's either usually it gets lower because you know the best evidence at first, right? Sometimes I suppose it could get better. The WATNA is the worst alternative to a negotiated settlement. And that's what you don't want to have happen, right? But you have to find out with your client, what can they tolerate? Can, if they lose at trial, everything, can they pay you? If they lose everything at trial, will their business be destroyed? Will their reputation be, where is that threshold where they cannot tolerate the worst case scenario? I've seen mediations where this isn't done, and it just kind of zigzags all over the place. It doesn't allow the parties to build a real good, solid negotiating plan because they don't know the end game. Jeff, do you have anything to add on that one?
I agree with you, and I hope I'm not stepping on your toes for the next point, but my approach is that I would get to number 8 after listening to the parties for some time because I want to establish a rapport with the decision makers. I want the decision makers to feel that they have told me their story before I get to the bat and the what.
Right. And I guess I'm thinking of this from the advocate's perspective. You're preparing for a mediation. The parties are going to decide how and when they're going to share that viewpoint with the mediator so that they can use the mediator in the most powerful manner.
Now, how do you get to the viewpoints about the BATNA and the WATNA and establishing this rapport if one of the parties is pro se? I mean, would you ever take some sort of a pro se mediation case?
I could relate a story that just happened about 6 months ago. It was a divorce, it was a family law mediation. And when the parties were, I didn't know that, well, at least initially when the call came in, I was told that one party was not represented. Or maybe the party was represented, but then when they got to the mediation, there was no lawyer. And it was the wife who was, had dismissed her lawyer. These people were foreign nationals. Okay, they were born in another country, in Europe, and they spoke with an interesting style of accent, which I'll try to imitate at least, and not in any mocking fashion, just to tell you how it came through. She was unrepresented, and I didn't know that until the thing was ready to start. And I said, do you want to go forward without a lawyer today? And she said yes. And I talked to the other side, and we all got together. We were in the same, the conference room together. And I said, any objection to me talking to her separately, like this? And I had my assistant come into the room with me, with her, and she was able to do that. She was free to do it. So it got to the point was about what was going to be divided in the family poke, you know, it was like, I said, well, we have to talk about this because this is what you're going to get in the divorce. The judge is going to give you this, he's going to get this, you're going to get that. And she said, this is how she said it. I only want one thing. I said, what is that? She said, I want him dead. Oh, wow. I really can't do that. I don't have that kind of authority. I said, but sometime it'll happen in the future. No, I want him dead today. Today. And I said, okay, we're not going to be able to do this today. So can we work on some other alternatives? So like, what would you like? And so we went through a whole list, and it settled, and everything went fine, and they are happily divorced, and they went to the court. And I let the judge know that this matter was coming in, and she was pro se. And I believed that everything was acceptable, but I asked the judge to kind of quiz it out first a touch before going in. And so it worked out fine, but I want him dead. Okay, that was it. I don't know if that answers your question, but the question evoked this memory. I'm sorry.
The reason why I ask is because I know our Triple M program is designed for people with attorneys, but occasionally we do have adversary cases that come in, and one of the parties is pro se. Maybe it's the Department of Workforce Development, or maybe it's a trustee bringing a preference action, and we're just trying to see, you know, is that the kind of case that could even be mediated, or is it just beyond hope because there is no person to steer them in the right direction of settlement?
That's a hard one because, yeah. I mean, we represent a lot of, or we mediate a lot of cases with parties who are not represented, and we're also lawyers, so we know things that they don't know about their case. But it kind of goes back to this triangle that mediators talk about of party satisfaction with mediators, or with the outcome of the mediation. And the outcome, substantively, is only one of three. Now, if you don't know what a win is, because you're not a lawyer, it's really hard to know if, well, gee, I got a great settlement, because the measure is this and this and this. But if you can get two of those three, you'll have a satisfied person. And the other one, or one of the other two, is emotional satisfaction. You know, I was heard, I had a chance to vent, I had my day, and that can happen in a mediation. And the other one is process satisfaction. I was treated fairly. You know, I didn't win. I didn't get exactly what I wanted, but I was treated fairly. It was reasonable. So with unrepresented parties, I think we look more to that triangle and satisfying them that way. Because you're right, they're not going to be able to do their BATNA necessarily.
Deborah?
Yes.
I think that attorney mediators have another thing to watch. I think they are ethical minefields, and particularly in the caucus process, because if you're in a caucus room with an unrepresented party, I don't care how many disclosures and times you tell that pro se mediation participant that you're not their attorney, your words are going to carry a tremendous amount of weight. So you have to watch out for that. And I would recommend to the any bar that is involved in mediation that they work very hard, if they're as part of mediation programs, to get representation for the process.
Yeah, I it is treacherous waters.
Well, and the idea, what happens even in a mediation with represented parties, and that's what you see, like 8, 7, and 6 are all kind of interrelated sections, but oftentimes I'm asked well into the process of mediation, well, what do you think? How do you think it should come out? What would your recommendation be? Well, that's a minefield in and of itself, because that's, and I explain ad nauseum that I'm not their lawyer in any fashion. They have a lawyer, and their lawyer knows the issues, and we're trying to work around them and with the issues from the other side as well. And I can't give them what they're looking for when they ask that kind of question. I can't give them my opinion as to how the case should turn out. I can tell them that, and I can and I will, based on my experience as a circuit court judge, when cases got tried a lot more than they do today, having had the experience of, I don't know how many thousand jury trials I was presided over in the 12 years I was on the bench, and talking to jury panels and finding out or hearing from them what they, why they decided the case they decided, the way they decided it, and hearing things like we liked or we didn't like, we believed or we didn't believe. Those are the basic responses from the jury panels. And I explained to them that the jurors are not professional, they are new ones on every case, the lawyers are different, the parties are different. So what are they going to like about this case or not like? What are they going to believe here? I'm sure they're going to believe you, but maybe they believe the other side a little more. It's so difficult to process that kind of questioning, but it gets asked all the time. You know, what do you think? What would you recommend?
I'm going to kind of lump 7 and 6 together because, I think they're really related, and they really tie to expectations. I've talked to other mediators, and they say the biggest obstacle to settling cases and why things kind of fall apart is the client just can't let go. They just can't say yes to that number. And, I mean, that's kind of based on this theory of loss aversion. When the client starts out in the case, they meet with three lawyers, they pick a lawyer, and they pick the lawyer who tells them the case is worth the most, or if they're defending, that they have no liability. So there the expectation is created. That's the benchmark against which they're going to measure any settlement offer. And if they take less than that, they have this feeling of loss. And they will do crazy things to avoid that feeling of loss. There's a study of Stanford students where they're going to a weekend seminar, and they were told it was free, but when they got there, they had to pay $20. And they were, 20, that's a loss. So to avoid that loss, they were given the opportunity to spin a wheel. They had to pay $100, and three out of the four chances were that they would get something free. Well, that really turned out, it would be better not to do that because you're paying $25 per chance. But they did it under this idea of loss aversion. What you can do as advocates is, again, manage those expectations early on. And then use those expectations in your negotiating plan. Set that out kind of ahead of time. Bill, I'm going to reactive evaluation. We talked about that. Number 5, the little dove there carrying the message. Use your mediator, right? What can you say about the messenger and getting the most bang for your buck?
Well, oftentimes the parties will look to incorporate the mediator to be the negotiator against the other side, and that's where you can get into problems. I think, is to present a proposition that might be something that might be acceptable. If it's acceptable to the party receiving the message, and to do that, and that will, it's almost like if they will you kind of idea, and not that they will, not that they're saying that they're not offering that, but they're suggesting that if it's a possibility, we can discuss this. And that's kind of, people scratch their heads a little bit on that because I don't even know what that means sometimes to get that to the point. The idea is that as the mediator, I have to be careful not to be the advocate for one side or the other in the process. And so I'm not sure if that answers what we're talking about.
Yep. I mean, part of why it's so hard to negotiate directly between just the attorneys is because anything that comes from the other side with whom your adversary is going to be met with distrust.
Right.
When you stick the mediator in between and the offer comes from the mediator, or the offer, it's not matured to an offer, but it's afloat.
Yes, floating. That's
you get away from some of that negative perception.
Well, then it becomes, well, then the parties will say between the lawyer and the, well, the mediator suggested, or you know, whoever, however they refer to me or you in the process, but what do you think of that? And so that kind of discussion will start taking place, which doesn't happen when it's direct negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Number four, this one's kind of fun and controversial. A mediator's proposal. How many of you have been involved in mediations where the mediator at the very end of the process, where there's, you know, there's that gap, has said, if you want to, I will help you bridge that gap with a mediator's proposal? Have any of you used that? I think it's more typically used in where an insurance company, have you?
Yeah.
Where an insurance company is one of the parties, they kind of expect it. And I'm not sure how I feel about it. I can see some perils for the mediator, but the idea is, let's say they're $20,000 apart, the mediator floats an offer privately, and if it's accepted by both parties, you have a deal. If it is declined by one party, the mediator doesn't disclose who declined it. So the one who declined it knows that they're the ones who caused it, but the other side doesn't know. And I mean, I think there's all kinds of creative ways to when you're at the very end, where a mediator can kind of jump in and bridge that gap. And I guess it's something that I would say, find out if that's something you're interested in, find out at the beginning if your mediator is willing to do something like that.
Well, what I've done is, in relationship to that process or that type of process, is to ask parties to identify a range of resolution. What would they find to be acceptable? And that's where you get into this idea of a mutually acceptable resolution. That's the key. And well, what would you find to be acceptable here? And how would you? Okay, so now I get that down. And I ask the other side, what would you find to be acceptable? How do you think this should? And between the two of them, then I can start working with their concepts of acceptability, and then those concepts can become actual propositions that are exchanged and will oftentimes resolve the matter. So.
Dealing with confidential information, one thing to test when you're selecting as a mediator is ensure that the mediator will allow you to decide how and when to disclose information, because information is power, and you may want to be very strategic about it, and build that into your negotiating plan. Disclosure of information oftentimes generates movement. Someone learns something new, they reevaluate their case, and they move. So you may want to parse out some of that information carefully. The most frustrating thing for a mediator is when they hear in a caucus, you know, I have this great piece of evidence. I have a video of this guy who says he's injured fixing his roof. Okay, great. Sounds like you're going to win. When are you going to use it? Well, at trial. Okay, but we're here to settle the case. If you don't give me the opportunity to use that tool, you're really shooting yourself in the foot in terms of getting something done today.
Have you been looking at some of my mediations?
No. I had one
where it was a personal injury, and the guy his complaint was that he hurt his back, he couldn't work, he couldn't do this, and he was a husky-looking fellow, a young guy in his 30s or so, and the offer pre-mediation by the defense to the plaintiff's claim was like $75,000 or $80,000. Okay. Which was this was 15 years ago. It was a lot of money. And when they got to the mediation, he submitted something confidential. Our offer has now been changed from $85,000 to $5,000. Oh, and this is confidential? Yes. The other side, so you didn't tell the plaintiff that you've dropped your offer from $85,000 to $5,000? No. Okay, well, you want to tell me why you did that? Well, because we have a video. We have a video of this guy redoing his whole backyard with wheelbarrows of dirt and bricks and rocks and logs. And when are you going to tell the other side? No. Okay. Why not? Well, we want to use it at trial. Okay. Well, do you want to try to settle it? We're not. I mean, what are we doing here?
Use it now.
Well, I'm not sure, Judd. What should we do? And I said, we don't want to give them. We don't want to give up our evidence. We don't want to let them know that conflict. See, this is the conflict. Win-win. I said, I tell you what. You stay here. I'll be back. That's what I told him I was going to do. I brought in a TV, like a screen with a video player connected to it. I had it rolled into the conference room, and the plaintiff's side said, well, what's that for? I said, well, maybe you might want to look at a film or a video. And he looked at me and he said, do they have something on tape? And I said, you got to draw your own conclusions from this. I need 5 minutes. Okay, the case settled like that. And it settled. Now, the defense went up from 5 to like 15 or something. They put more money in. But the demand of the plaintiff was like $250,000. That went down to 30 or 50 or something. And so the case did settle. But that's exactly what happened.
You can, as an advocate, you can share something, but not in an evidentiary fashion. You can have the mediator stamp on it, mediation communication confidential. You can tell the mediator that they can bring it in, but they have to take it back with them. You can have it, now people can take pictures with their phones, but I was going to say it could be in a display. But there are ways that you can use that powerful evidence and still preserve the value of it as evidence at trial. And I know we're getting close to time, aren't we?
Yeah.
So we've got two
can
more left.
Quickly get, wrap up the last two?
Yep. Get it in writing. It kind of goes without saying, right? You don't want buyer's remorse and have everything undone, and you don't want to deal with memories that fail. It doesn't have to be an enforceable agreement, but get the key points down in writing. And Bill,
yes.
Wrap it up with cookies.
Okay, this is the key to all successful mediations. All right, right here. We have it right here. Always make sure that you have both chocolate chips and something healthy like something healthy, cookie, and a chocolate chip cookie. All right, so that's the key to a successful mediation. And it's, as indicated, it's an icebreaker. People say, oh, really, cookies? I mean, this is like, they don't expect it. I tell them, when you go to court, by the way, all the things that don't happen in court, you don't get cooked. The judge doesn't serve cookies in court, okay? So you're going to get them
here.
Some
of us do.
Some do.
I brought cookies one time because I thought these parties were ready to settle it up.
Yeah.
And then they said, we're not quite there, Judge. So I went back to my office and I ate all the cookies. Thank you so much to our panel.
Jeff,
today.
Thank you.
Really
Jeff, thank you so much.
To Jeff on the phone, thank you so much. We'll be in touch to get some tips. We are trying to put together a more formal mediation program here, and it just sounds like you guys have it figured out. So thank you for getting up so early and participating. Remember to come back the first week in May for an evidence presentation with Judge Pepper, and then in June, the second week in June, for our mock presentation that's being set up by Mont Martin. Thanks again, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff, are you still there?